Here we stand. I am your host, Kevin Anantikal, Strong Voice. Welcome back. It is March 3rd, 2019. That was Hazel Dickens singing from the coal fields of West Virginia, an old miners' union song there. And I was always told by my mentors many, many years ago when I got into this work to always start your meetings with music. We've got to keep our spirits up, brothers and sisters, especially when we're dealing with these horrible, horrible subjects. Now, a lot of you are tuning in today for the first time. We've got an incredible new number of listeners on the program, partly thanks to an interview I did with Sarah Westall over the last little while. Believe it or not, it's had over 500,000 hits. This is the recent news about the removal palace coup against Jorge Bergoglio, a.k.a. Pope Francis, and other things that we're going to be talking about today. I'm very honored and pleased to have with me today Ella Sturr. She's a Dutch journalist. And her website is ellastur.nl for you folks interested in her background. We're going to bring her on in a minute, but I did have a couple of I haven't slept for 24 hours. Couple of things to mention to folks before we get started. A lot of you have been writing in saying, what can we do to stop these crimes of genocide by the church and by others? Well, very simple. Do what we've done for over 20 years and take it into the community, put it into the streets, confront these people directly. And we have an example of that coming up between April 14th and 21st is being declared a week of action by the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State. In at least five countries, there'll be direct actions to arrest known child raping priests, enforce standing arrest warrants, urging Catholic and other church members to stop giving money to these churches, lobbying governments to cut off the tax-exempt status of the Catholic Church, and that kind of direct action. It's going to culminate during so-called Holy Week, April 14th to 21st. Interesting, too, that week has a lot of memories for me. April 15th in 2005, we began Aboriginal Holocaust Day in Canada, where we began to force these crimes out. Now, you can see a lot of this evidence at our website, murderbydecree.com. Our tribunal website, the ITCCS.org site, is still sabotaged, still down. We are transferring the updates and other important information from that website to murderbydecree.com, so you can start seeing the updates at that site. Write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. Also, I'll mention some of this when I'm talking to Ella, because it's all relevant, so I won't repeat ourselves now, but please do stay tuned for the coming programs, because we're going to be having more interviews with people who have taken down these Ninth Circle rituals, including the recent one in Rome that was stopped by some common law sheriffs. Hopefully we'll have one of them on, although, interestingly, one of them was there was an attempted kidnapping of the team leader after the takedown in Rome, and this person's in hiding now. But, you know, these are the kind of counterattacks we always get when we disrupt these Ninth Circle satanic sacrificial cult rituals. So take heart, people. We are carrying on this battle, teaching you how to fight back, not just learn information, but what to do about it on the ground. Now, I'll bring Ella in now. Hello, Ella. Are you there?
How are you?
Hello, Ella.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. It's really good to have you. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me. I wanted to ask
if you could give folks a little bit of a background who you are before we get into the meat of the topic tonight.
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, I've been active in the truth community since early 2014. And I started my own blog in April 2016 as a citizen's journalist. We have written over 400 articles covering various topics. And our best read article, and you're going to be pleased about it, is about the intervention of the ITCCS in Zwolle, the northeast of the Netherlands, where a planned satanic ritual was stopped. I've been following the work of the ITCCS since early 2014, and I've been researching pedophile networks, spoken to a number of witnesses, abuse victims, insiders, and other researchers. And I read many books and documents about the subject, and the conclusion is that there's an extensive international pedophile network operating in the Netherlands, Belgium, France, other countries.
Right.
And we will talk about it hopefully in the show.
Oh, yes, that's what we're going to be talking about. Now, of course, the big stuff in the news is the relationship. One of the issues, of course, is the relationship between the present Pope, Pope Francis Jorge Bergoglio, and Maxime Zuriaga, the Queen of the Netherlands. And I know you've done an amazing amount of research on this. I wondered if you could kind of start on that issue and share with us some of what you know about them.
Yes. Well, about the news that you brought forward last week, the jury for me is still out on the claim of whether they had a romance or not. But however, there are clear signs that they have a very special relationship. It becomes very clear on factual things that come forward. For instance, they both originate from Argentina, and according to this Argentinian magazine, Princess Maxima donated $200,000 to Bergoglio at a time when he was a cardinal and archbishop in Buenos Aires, and that was roughly $15,000 a month. And she gave him that money to expand the reach of a television channel of the cardinal and the archbishop.
Right.
So that's quite remarkable.
Amazing.
And of course, these claims were later disputed, and the story was spinned that it was fake news, and the media spread more lies about Maxima, blah, blah, blah. What I find interesting, I found this claim by the Government Information Service, and this is the official service that makes the reports in regards to the royal family. And they declared that Maxima did not know Bergoglio personally and had never met him prior to 2008. I find this remarkable because I have the impression that Bergoglio was a friend of the family.
Right.
And also, Maxima studied at the Catholic University in Buenos Aires. She studied economics between 1989 and 1995. And this university was directed by local bishops, among whom Bergoglio. So she studied there, she graduated, but she never met him. Interesting.
Well, it's also interesting that her own father was good friends. Could you tell about Jorge Zuriaga and his relationship with the military junta and Bergoglio?
Yeah, there's some interesting things to tell about the Zuriagas, for sure. I would actually like to add a little more to what I just previously said.
Sure.
There was a state visit to the Vatican when the current Dutch king, Willem-Alexander, and her Maxima, his new wife, visited the Vatican, an official state visit. And this was filmed. And when Maxima and Bergoglio met, their faces lighted up. So it was very clear that they knew each other very well.
Right.
So, that's in contrast with what...
It's always those little things that kind of give things away, isn't it?
Yeah. You can't hide that.
Right.
But in regards to Zuriaga, of course, he was a minister of agriculture in the Videla dictatorship. And when Maxima engaged Willem-Alexander, there was a lot of fuss about people didn't want him, George Zorgeta, to attend the wedding because of his involvement in the disappearance of 30,000 political prisoners that were either killed or, they disappeared. And so they sent someone to do a formal investigation, which really means a whitewash operation, usually. But even they had to admit that they couldn't prove that he was personally responsible for it, but it was very unlikely that he had not known about it because there were so many.
Well, there's also a point in international law. It's called command responsibility. You don't have to have personally done it, but if you're part of the regime, if you're in an executive position in the regime that's killing off people, mm-hmm. you have command responsibility, just like the Pope does, for all the actions of his employees.
Right. And he was also implicated in a whitewash scandal, where because he was in the board of directors of Banco Republica during the time when the bank was accused of whitewashing the profits derived from narco trafficking and weapon trafficking, illegal weapon trafficking. And this bank, Banco Republica, did business with large drug cartels, and they also paid large sums of bribes that were part of the deal. So another scandal, and he was never convicted for it, but well, according to reports, this was because of the corruption amongst Argentinian judges. And well, we see the same pattern here. When there's high profile people involved, there's no real justice system.
No.
They use the system to
One thing I want to ask too, during this period, during the Dirty Wars, of course, Argentina went to war, the Falklands War, with Great Britain. And it turns out later in a book called In God's Name about the murder of John Paul I in 1978, the Vatican Bank had been paying for Exocet missiles for the Argentine government. Now, do you have any evidence that Bergoglio, who was the archbishop then, was involved in that transaction? Or is there anything tied to that? Did you come across anything like that?
No, but I haven't researched that, so...
Okay. And, of course, the interesting thing about Bergoglio is that he went, in 3 years in Argentina, he went from being a priest to heading the Jesuits. He was the superior general of the Jesuits in just 3 years. Right at the same time, the military coup happens, and then he's good buddies with the junta. Priests have accused him of fingering left-wing priests to the military junta, who were then killed. Turning a blind eye to allegations of child trafficking and murder, and even trafficking children of political prisoners. These are all accusations coming up from the priests. So what is your sense of, like, well, we'll get into that is this, to you, indicative of something more than just crime? I mean, it keeps coming back to Noriega all the time as well.
Yes, well... I haven't researched Bergoglio's involvement as much, but one thing that I find very telling about the Zorreguetas is the work of art of Dolores Zorreguieta. See, Jorge Zorreguieta, the Maxima's father, was previously married, and he had three children in his first marriage. And Dolores Zorreguieta is Maxima's half-sister. And she's an artist, and the pieces of art she creates are very interesting and very telling. There is a piece that's called The War of the Helicopters, and it's an illustration of a war scene where people are being dumped in a pit or incinerator.
Right.
And if you look at her entire collection, it's sheer Satanism, it's horror, childhood trauma, bloody sculptures, dresses made of bloody band-aids, a dress made of human tissue dripping blood, graphics of people in bondage, in cages, in extreme state of pain or horror, sculptures of genetically modified monsters. And even more disturbing and more telling is the series The Children Project, that are clear references to satanic ritual abuse of children. For instance, a white doll's carriage with a bloody trail. I mean, it's really just beyond.
And this is all produced by the half-sister of Maxima Zorreguieta, Queen of the Netherlands.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So you wonder what she had been through in her childhood, and she found art to express her childhood trauma. And then another interesting aspect is that Maxima's younger sister from the second marriage, Ines Zorreguieta, committed suicide last year. I believe it was last year. And she was 33 years old, and there's also rumors that she was suicided, so that
Well,
it was done by an outside force.
it's like that last Saturday when the Ninth Circle ritual was supposed to be scheduled, a woman called Natasha Jait was found dead in her apartment. She was an Argentine journalist who had publicly accused Jorge Bergoglio's good friend of being involved in child trafficking, and then she's dead the day after he is removed and the Ninth Circle thing occurs. You know, I don't think these things are coincidences.
No, probably not. No. And it's interesting that you mentioned the help of the Vatican in the Dirty War. I'd like to point out another thing that sort of links also the Zorriguetas and the House of Orange together. Both families like to spend their winter holidays in Bariloche. And Bariloche is a Swiss-like area in Argentina. It's a holiday resort, and it actually looks like Switzerland. And it's frequented during the winter for skiing holidays. And both the Zorriguetas had a home there, and now the royal family has a home there too. But this happened to be the region where Nazi criminals created their enclave after they escaped the Nuremberg trials after the Second World War.
Right.
And they settled down there. And there's even disclosed documents from the FBI or CIA that Hitler had escaped to Argentina and most likely to ex this exact same region. And Prince Bernard, the grandfather of the current king and husband of Maxima, he had met the Zorriguetas, sorry, already in the Second World War. I'm sorry, I'm coming down with a cold, so.
I'm sorry.
But they had already met, and apparently, well, just one second.
Yep, that's fine. I should just mention to listeners, too, that both King Willem's father and grandfather were Dutch Nazis. Prince Bernhard, the grandfather, was a member of the Hitler's personal bodyguard. Prince Klaus was a member of the Hitler Youth. So again, here's the Nazi connection with the Dutch family and Bergoglio.
Yes, that's an important detail. And there are also claims that Prince Bernhard helped Nazi criminals escape. And also, the Dutch airline company KLM is implicated in the escape of the Nazis to Argentina and South America.
Yeah, there was a
So
major
there's.
major route of what they call the rat line, the Vatican rat lines, where they'd smuggle Nazis out through Italy, monasteries, Franciscan monasteries, and also, of course, through rural families.
Yeah, so Prince Bernhard already met the Zorriguetas in the Second World War, and he probably met with Maxima's grandfather or great uncle. And the years after the war, he frequented, well, he frequently visited Bariloche for his winter holidays, and maybe even during the Dirty War. And there are also reasons to believe that the marriage between Willem-Alexander and Maxima is an arranged marriage. So
Well, bringing this
that's.
to the Netherlands now, unless there's more stuff you want to share about Argentina.
No, but what I'd like to point out, and as you said, both Prince Bernhard and Prince Klaus were Nazis, but also these names keep popping up in reports about satanic abuse and sexual abuse and involvement in pedophile networks. So
Well, in
that's.
terms of the Netherlands, let's talk about the ties. Of course, you might have to tell folks a little bit about who Marc Dutroux is and his ties to some of these people.
Sure. Marc Dutroux was a Belgian child molester in the 90s. And he was arrested in 1996 for the disappearance of six girls. And when he was arrested, two girls that were kept captive in his basement were released. And they found the bodies of four girls that were buried on his estate. And what was remarkable about his case is that the first investigative judge, which was Jean-Marc Conrot, during the investigation, he made a call out for witnesses to report anything directly or indirectly related to the Dutroux case, and he promised anonymity. And these and like so many people came forward, they didn't expect it, and these were the ex-witnesses. So instead of putting their names in the criminal file, they put an X plus a number, and there's at least up to 69 ex-witnesses. And they started to report about large orgies with children and a large child prostitution network in Belgium, where high-profile people were involved and even nobility. They started to talk about human hunting parties in the gardens of castles, not just in Belgium, but also in the Netherlands. And there's all these connections also in the reports with situations in the Netherlands. So it was very clear that it was that Dutroux was part of a larger network, and the authorities freaked out and they removed the first investigative judge, and they replaced him with a successor, Jacques Langlois. And the country was at a point of a breakdown, you know, it was almost falling apart. And then they put this judge that had zero experience, he was a novice, so he could be manipulated, and he made a 180 degrees U-turn, and he conveniently believed that Dutroux was a sole perpetrator. He was not involved in an extensive prostitution network. And during this investigation, 30 witnesses were killed or disappeared or died under mysterious circumstances.
And I remember reading a comment by that first judge, Jean-Marc Conrad, who said, "The mafia is running this case." That was a direct quote when he...
Mm-hmm.
I remember, too, Laurent Louis, a former Belgian member of parliament, claimed that there were two court records, one in which Dutroux had claimed that there were members of the Dutch royal family at these things, and then the eventual record had all that wiped out of it. Do you remember seeing anything about that?
Yes. I don't know if the Dutch royal family was implicated in it directly. I don't know the Dutroux case, but every detail of it, but I can't remember that was mentioned.
It was mentioned to me by Anne-Marie van Bleenberg when she gave her testimony about witnessing
These
hunting parties. And also Marcel, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. You're going to have to do it.
Marcel Verfloesem.
Yes,
Verfloesem,
he mentioned that to me as well. Yep.
Yes. Well, and also Laurent Louis, he showed the autopsy photos of the of Julie and Melissa. They Dutroux was arrested previously, and he wanted to show that they did not die because of hunger during his imprisonment, but that they died of the abuse, and that somebody else was taking these girls out and abusing them. And that he had external help. And Dutroux also wrote letters to the parents of the victims, pointing out that he was part of a larger network.
And, you know, it's interesting that Anne-Marie had mentioned that she had seen Prince Frigio, the younger brother, King Willem-Alexander, who's now, Frigio is now dead. But he was at these things, George Soros, top Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, and royal family members at these things.
Well, and her claim that has been spread worldwide has never been disputed. And I've written personally to members of parliament to ask them to ask questions in Parliament and confront the Prime Minister with these allegations, because these are serious allegations. And it also involved the head of state, which is under the responsibility of the Prime Minister. And despite the fact that all these influential people were implicated and accused of horrible crimes, nobody responded. Nobody denied the claims. I find this really strange and, well, not strange, but telling, very telling.
Yes. Well, it's interesting, Ella, because it's exactly the same pattern we encountered in Canada over many years. Like, no one's ever sued me from the churches and government. They've never disputed any of the evidence. They just try to isolate, marginalize myself and a few other people doing this work. That's an admission of guilt under the law. If you're not disputing what's being said about you, it's tacit agreement. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yes, it is very telling, for sure.
Yeah.
So, during the Marc Dutroux case, there was another case that broke in the same year that the investigation was going full throttle. In 1998, Marcel Verfloesem received a CD-ROM with a large collection of child pornography, which he had been given by Gerry Ulrich, who had an apartment in Zandvoort, which is west of Amsterdam. It's a beach town next to Haarlem. And Zandvoort, this apartment in Zandvoort, was the epicenter of the child porn network. And on this CD-ROM, which he handed over to Interpol and the Dutch police and the Belgian police, were 90,000 images, and two-thirds was not known to Interpol. And not only the volume of the material was quite remarkable, but also the violence against children and the young ages were quite shocking. There was material of toddlers and babies being abused or raped. There were images of children being tortured and sometimes killed. And it was a huge scandal. It also got in the hands of a French reporter called Serge Grand, and he was writing for the French newspaper L'Humanité. And he made a cover story of the Zandvoort case. He handed over the CD-ROM to the French authorities, even though they could have gotten it from Interpol, but nevertheless. And the French authorities said, well, there's no need to investigate. It's old material from the 70s or 80s, and these children participated voluntarily.
Oh, a baby. Baby participates voluntarily, right?
Well, regardless,
criminal.
I mean, a 12-year-old is being raped. I mean, come on. And it was clear that it was material from an international network, and the Zandvoort files have been linked to Belgium, France, Great Britain, particularly a foster home there, Portugal, Germany, and other European countries.
Right.
And in France, they... So the French authorities like to sort of cover it up, but what happened was that hundreds of parents started to call the newspaper L'Humanité and said, can we please look at the files to see if my child is in there? And they comprised a photo book where they took the portraits that were derived from the pornographic material. So people could look, sort of sift through this portrait book, and 81 French parents recognized their child in the Zandvoort collection.
Oh, God.
And their identification was denied every single time. The authorities told the parents, no, you're making a mistake. This is not your child, because it has already been identified in the Netherlands. For instance, it was called Björn IJskamp, and then an investigator went to the Netherlands and they looked into the file, and this Björn IJskamp didn't exist. So they made up all these invented
Right.
identities to make sure that nobody was identified. And there was a pediatrician, psychologist, who a French doctor, and he had treated two children for trauma caused by sexual abuse, and he recognized these two children in the files. There was a French child trafficker, Emile Louis. He was convicted for the disappearance of two girls. He had never been online. He had no access to the internet. And despite this, the two pictures of the girls popped up in the Zandvoort files. And despite all this, it
yeah,
was
sorry, go ahead.
Blocked. The investigation was blocked.
Amazing. Well, it's not amazing. That happens all the time, this high-level state and court complicity in hiding this, protecting the perpetrators. How did Marcel originally get that file? From who and why did they bring it to him?
From what I know is that he was looking into the disappearance of a German boy called Manuel Schwartwald. And he was abducted from Berlin, and he ended up in a child prostitution network in Amsterdam. And this trail in search of the boy led to the Netherlands. And he had a talk with Robbie van Planken, and I think he was the partner of Gerry Ulrich, but that I'm not sure of. But he said, well, talk to Ulrich, and he has more information of the whereabouts of this German boy. And then Marcel said he came into the apartment and he saw eight computers running child pornography movies. So they probably were downloading or uploading stuff to the internet. And he realized that this was the epicenter of this child porn network. And
people often wonder why. I mean, it's a huge global industry, and there's a lot of money involved. And have you, in your research, have you been able to follow the money at all, or have you gotten that far? But who's funding this? We know organized crime during Gaeta and the Mafia in Europe are providing children and others for these rituals, but and they've got strong ties with the Vatican, of course. But have you come across this yet? Is anyone looking into the financial end of this?
Well, there's remarkable details that sort of stand out. For instance, this Robbie van Planken said that in the apartments of Gerry Ulrich, they found order forms where you could order a child, what kind of child you would like to have and what kind of abuse you would like to perform. And for a snuff movie production where the child would die, they would be able to get a million, probably guilders at the time. So what kind of people are involved? People that can pay this money. Because if the Robert M. case, and hopefully we can get into this in this show as well, because it is an important case. Very young children were sold for 15,000 euros for, you know, a morning or an afternoon. So we're talking about high-profile people that have the money to spend on their perverse needs.
Definitely. Go on.
So this Zandvoort case is a really important case because it sort of ties all these other cases together.
Okay.
And this investigation was stopped in France. It was stopped in Belgium. It was stopped in the Netherlands. This was all taking place while the Dutroux investigation was also going on. And the media also played a very significant role because they downplayed the case to whitewash the scandal. Like Gerry Ulrich had operated on his own and he was already killed. There were only 60,000 images found and only 710 images were child pornography. which was a lie. The ages of the children abused were 10 to 12, which was a lie. The identities could not be traced, which was a lie. There was no evidence of a network, which was a lie. So there was all these lies that they put out in order to just kill the investigation. But in the meanwhile,
this is the mainstream media, right?
Yes.
In Netherlands, Belgium, where?
Well, this was in the Netherlands, and we've also studied many dossiers related to abuse in Dutch schools, and this is directly related to the Zandvoort case, because in the 90s, roughly end of 80s, up until 2010, so roughly 20 years, hundreds of children have been abused in Dutch schools and in at least one daycare center. And of some of these victims, photographic material has been found in this Zandvoort case. And maybe it's good to sort of list the abuses that took place in this time frame, because it's quite shocking. And it's, see, what we did, Kevin, is that we put all these files together, and I've received a trove of information from a key witness in a very important pedophile lawsuit. And we saw these connections, like this is taking place in the same people play a role in this case, and this is in the same location. So maybe it's good to sort of go through this list.
Please, yeah.
In 1997, there was a sex scandal where it was exposed that the director of a primary school in Friesland, the Trochvaart in Seksbieren, which is the northeast of the country, had abused 8 children. But according to our sources, this abuse had already taken place for 20 years. So if you multiply 8 by 10 or 20, you get the real number of victims. This is a pattern that they let these perpetrators just, you know, continue their perverse actions. There was another scandal in 1987 in Oude Pekela in Groningen, also the northeast of the country. This was not in a school, but it involved, reports say 50 to 100 children, but I talked to the father of one of two of the victims recently, and he said there's hundreds of victims. The children were kidnapped, taken to locations in the village, and the perpetrators were wearing clown masks. The children were drugged, raped, child pornography was produced, and there were reports of satanic ritual abuse. Now, this is an important line, because you will hear it more often. Nobody got prosecuted. The justice and media said the abuse never took place. It's a matter of mass hysteria. The primary care physician who examined some of these children insisted that 50 children were indeed abused, and he was suicided. I'm saying suicided because it's too convenient. I don't believe he committed suicide.
You mean the physician who examined them was found dead after?
Yeah, because he kept insisting that these children were indeed abused.
Right.
There was a Belgian professor, Gerrit Mick, who said the same thing. It's not a matter of mass hysteria. The abuse was real. He died of a heart attack. So let's continue. The next scandal broke, 1996. Primary school De Dreef, Emma Compascum, that's also northeast of the country. 18 to 20 children were abused, 4 years and older. The suspect were the director and two teachers, and also parents were complicit in the crime. The abuse took place in basements, in the basement, and locations outside of the school. The children were drugged, raped, child pornography was produced, and also reports of satanic ritual abuse. also the mention of clown masks. And the director that was implicated in this case apparently also played a role in the previous case I mentioned in Oudepekela. So there's all these connections. So nobody was prosecuted. And despite the fact that photos of two victims were found in the Zandvoort files, but the media and the Justice Department said the abuse did not take place. It's a matter of mass hysteria and a conspiracy theory.
And so there's a common system at work here, in other words. The same thing happens,
yes.
The same cover-up. It's a routine. It's organized.
Yes, it is organized. There's so many people involved in this. And it even goes further, and this is another pattern that we see more often. The parents that kept insisting that the children were abused, they were sued for libel and slander and were fined. They had to pay a fine of 15,000 guilders, which was enough to ruin an average family. Roughly in the same year, another school, a primary school, Tambourijn in Assen, which is just very close to this previous school, 50 children were abused. The abuse took place in the basement. The teacher was convicted, 240 hours of compulsory community service. We think this case is also linked to other abuse and murder cases, and we suspect that this basement was used for child traffickers.
I wanted to ask you too, Ella, mm-hmm. One of the things Anne-Marie van Blienberg mentioned was her husband, Kees van Korler, was a member of this mm-hmm. mafia group, Drangheta, or what they call the Octopus. He said to her that they were getting the children through Queen Beatrix, that she mm-hmm. would authorize children to be brought from youth detention centers, and then they'd be used in these hunting parties where they're then killed. Have you come across that kind of role connection in the people you've been talking to?
Not in these cases, but I think this is that's another level, because the children that were abused in these schools were used for the child pornography,
right.
And so they were mostly not killed. So it's almost like you have two worlds,
different levels. Yeah.
Different levels, but it's interesting that in one of the cases, like in Emmecom Baskum, apparently a journalist had done some extensive research, and she ended up, she was stopped at a certain point. She said, I cannot go any further than that, than this, because it's because of the interest of the state or national security. And the name that was mentioned was Salomonsson, the attorney of Queen Beatrix. And this name keeps popping up together with Prince Klaus, that were both involved in these pedophile networks and violent sex with minors.
Now, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I want you to have you back to go into a lot more of the details of the research you've done, which is voluminous. But I wanted to ask you that because people have been sending me emails saying talk about alternatives, since the courts are obviously part of the problem and the government. There have been attempts not only by the ITCCS but other groups to look at this outside the legal system. Do you have any ideas of how citizens can take action themselves to stop these things and at least document and expose it more?
Well, I think there's still a lot of exposing to do, because there's so many people that are not, they have a hard time to believe this because it's so grotesque and it's so massive and large scale and organized. So, I think there still needs to be education of the masses, because if you set up your own courts, you need large numbers. But I was also thinking of another solution that might work is we need more whistleblowers, because right now the Dutch justice system is in a lockdown. and they all protect each other at a certain level. And it's not safe for insiders or whistleblowers or victims to come forward. So, what if other countries protect witnesses from abroad and put them in a witness protection program if, there are these cases involved? And so, because you need a couple of insiders that want to expose this stuff, and then everything can start rolling.
Well,
So.
we've found it's good you're saying this because we found that, for example, with the Vatican, just yesterday, yet another Jesuit archbishop resigned, and he's in Lithuania, a guy called Leonas Virbalis. He's the Archbishop of Konos in Lithuania, appointed by Bergoglio, another Jesuit. He steps down for health reasons. So, I mean, these guys are beginning to fall, and the more that happens, the more people realize. You know, it's safe to come forward and talk about this stuff now, and that's why there's this enormous faction fight going on at the high level of the Vatican now. So, with that atmosphere, I think it's possible now for these citizen courts tribunals to get off the ground more. There's more legitimacy to it than there was when we started it first 9 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that if a few prominent whistleblowers step forward, then you will also see that from the inside things will begin to shift. And then people have to make a choice, like on which sides do I want to be? Because it's no longer business as usual. These people have been gotten away with the worst crimes for years and years. And it's connected to the political top. Politicians are blackmailed with compromising photographs of participating in pedophile parties. And so you need a few people to sort of stir up the pot and say, okay, now we have a different era now. And there is a large group of people worldwide who want to end this ridiculous system. And because everyone deep down inside knows that this is really wrong. And I think there are so many people who want to step out of it or step forward that do not feel safe to do so. But somebody who's now willing to step forward could also be some sort of hero for at least bringing this forward and breaking it open. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think during when the Dutroux case was going on, wasn't there huge demonstrations in Belgium and
Yes.
the Netherlands, like tens of thousands of people objecting to the
No,
shutting down of the courts?
hundred thousands of people.
That's
Yeah,
amazing.
the yes, it was called the White March, Marche Blanche. Yeah, people were really upset, and the country almost broke, was almost torn apart. And I think what was interesting, I read in this article of in Die Welt, which was related to these topics, to the Dutroux case, but also this international pedophile network, that 80% of Belgian people do not believe they have been told the truth or in the Dutroux case. So people know that they've been lied to. And I think that the Netherlands has not yet that awareness. People are more sleepier, I feel.
Well, it's funny you say that because we would be lucky in Canada or America to be able to get 50 or 100 people out to a protest about child traffic and child abuse. There's fear around the whole issue. No one will respond. So for you to have several hundred thousand people, that's amazing. And partly I think it's the European climate, political climate, but someone was wondering, they just sent me an email, why Belgium and Holland? Why are these countries so rife with it, or is it everywhere, or is it particularly in those countries?
Well, they say that it's that the Netherlands is sort of playing a key role in this, but let's not forget the sex scandals in Great Britain. Let's not forget the sex scandals in Portugal, and let's not forget that the Dutroux case in the Dutroux case Children were abducted from Slovakia and Poland. I think this is an international network, and
Definitely.
yeah, it's happening everywhere, but I happen to live in the Netherlands, so I'm exposing things that are going on right here. But if somebody else would do the same in Poland or Romania, you probably this similar stories would come out.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I agree with you. And we have to look at this in an international sense. Do you have, I've got a few more minutes, 3 or 4 more minutes. Do you have, and I want you back soon, but could you talk about anything that you want to flag for people, like your website or things coming up or anything?
Well, my website is alastair.nl, and I don't really know. Well, we can talk in the future about the Robert M. case,
yes.
Which ties into what we just discussed, and also the failed attempt to convict the alleged pedophile Joris Demmink, which was the Secretary General of the Justice Department. And he played an important role in as a gatekeeper. And it's an interesting case. He has been acquitted, I think, last year. But they tried to convict him for almost 19 years. And it's also related to the story of a political prisoner that's in a Dutch prison cell for over 22 years. We have a Nelson Mandela, but his name is Bay Basin. He's a Kurdish businessman. And it is all related to this these stories and these cases. So there's...
Yeah.
Much more to talk about in the future.
Well, we will. And this Joris Demmink, you're saying, actually, he was named by Anne-Marie van Bleenberg as being at one of these human hunting parties just outside Brussels. And the area was cordoned off by Belgian troops. And, you know, so these, like you say, it's a very high organized state level, church level
mm-hmm.
involvement. Ella, we're going to wrap up in a few minutes, so I want to thank you for being with us today, and we'll talk very soon to have you back on so we can go into these other cases.
Okay, well, thank you for having me, and continue your good work.
Thank you. Thank you, Ella. You too. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That was Ella Stur from the Netherlands. Her website, again, is Ella Stur, that's E-L-L-A-S-T-E-R, .N for Norman, L for Lewis, ellastur.nl. And a number of announcements that we didn't cover before. Hearing these testimonies, it's clear that we, the people, have to take this action ourselves. We have had over 500,000 hits of the interview with Sarah Westall, but out of those 511,000 views, we've had a whopping 43 responses. Now, folks, that's 1 out of 10,000 of you that are responding. I very much appreciate the responses, but what is going on? If 500,000 of you people listen to this and only 43 respond, there's something seriously wrong here. So as you heard from Ella, children are being killed by high-level church and government people as we speak, and it's our obligation to stop this. Now, I mentioned before, April 14th to 21st, International Week of Action. There will be citizen arrests, direct actions of all sorts, especially at Catholic churches, but also Church of England, United Church in Canada, other proven criminal bodies that have the blood of the innocent on their hands. And we need you to volunteer to organize action groups. Now, this is groups of anywhere from 2 to 5 people. We operate small to avoid infiltration and destruction. We found that when you take direct action at these churches, you get responses. We achieved it in Canada in 2008, forcing the apology out of the government for the genocide in Indian schools. We helped depose Pope Benedict in 2013. Bergoglio himself has been brought down. We showed through direct action that you can get results. And so the initiative is now in your hands. Write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. We will send you flyers to hand out to Catholics asking them to stop putting money in the collection plate, campaign to lobby politicians who are sympathetic to cancel tax exemptions for the Catholic Church. These are the things that are going to get results. And you can also get all sorts of material from us to disseminate in 5 different languages. We have translators to do that for you. So I'm asking all of you to listen, to do more than listen, to think of those children who are going to die tomorrow if we don't act. And I want to close with a poem from William Coombs. Now, William, last Tuesday was the 8th anniversary of his killing. He was a Native man who was killed, according to the attending nurse, Erica Kelly. He was killed with lethal arsenic poisoning at St. Paul's Hospital. He had all the symptoms of arsenic poisoning, St. Paul's Catholic Hospital in Vancouver. He had seen Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip abduct 10 Native children from the Kamloops Catholic School in October 1964, never seen again. William wrote these words before he died. A crime has been committed, continually admitted. The offender has been acquitted and let walk free. We are all still in chains here in the darkness, hiding from their eyes. We're stuck. We cannot leave. Tucked away, we have no luck. Take us to heart. Take up the fight. Seek justice for our plight. I saw, I saw, I saw. Those were the words of William Coombs. He handed me that on an envelope one day in 2006, and he paid the ultimate price, but we have to remember that these eyewitnesses and those who are going to die tomorrow need us to speak and act for them because they can't do it for themselves. So it's a personal appeal. Tune in again next week. Follow our work, murderbydecree.com. Write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com, and act. The final song, I think, is an appropriate one. It's self-explanatory. Thank you.
All right, this is the last thing you're going to hear tonight. It's a happy song, but it's got... It's complicated words, so just listen really hard. Fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, he's a fucking motherfucker. Fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, he's a total motherfucker. Fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck him, fuck the motherfucker. Fuck the